88.1 WIPR. I'm Tom Hall. It's Friday morning, and it's Maryland morning. We begin with another look at discrimination in the mortgage lending market. Scholars who took a deep dive into Baltimore's banking practices found that for years, if you were black, you were at a distinct disadvantage to get a loan on favorable terms and to build wealth. Their work has just won them the 2016 John Hope Franklin Prize for writing on race, racism, and the law. Has anything changed since the housing bubble burst? Professor Jacob Rue on how inequality manifests itself before you sign on the dotted line. Then producer Rob Sivak joins our movie mavens, Jed Dietz and Anne Hornaday, for a recap of film festivals in Baltimore and Cannes, and Andrew Balio, the principal trumpet player of the Baltimore Symphony Orchestra, on the Future Symphony Institute, an organization he founded to create a new model for classical music. Gil Sandler has a Baltimore story. Maryland Morning kicks off right after these headlines.
I'm producer Rob Sivak. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming online at wypr.org/listen. Now, on with the show.
Morning, everybody. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Glad you're with us. Back in 2012 and 2013, then Maryland Morning producer Lawrence Lanahan, WIPR's Sheila Cast, myself, and other members of the Maryland Morning team produced a weekly series called The Lines Between Us, which examined the many ways in which inequality was manifested in the Baltimore region. This morning, a conversation about one of the things that we focused on then, discrimination in the mortgage lending market. Dr. Jacob Rue is professor of sociology at Brigham Young University in Utah, who, along with colleagues from Princeton University and Northeastern University, published an article last year in a journal called Social Problems, which studied mortgage lending in Baltimore from 2000 to 2008, when the real estate market and the U.S. economy went into a deep recession. Tomorrow night, Professor Rue and his colleagues will be awarded the John Hope Franklin Prize for the best article on race, racism, and the law published within the last 2 years. The prize is named after the great historian and civil rights pioneer who studied racial politics. Jacob Rue joins me on the phone from Provo, Utah. Good morning, Professor, and congratulations on the award.
Thank you. Good morning. Great to be here.
So first thing is, how does a guy from Provo, Utah, and a guy from Princeton, New Jersey, and another guy from Boston, Massachusetts, end up studying mortgage rates in Baltimore?
Well, the short answer is that we were all together at Princeton at one time when I was a PhD student, and this builds on previous research that Doug Massey and I have done that documented nationally that the more segregated a metropolitan area, the more foreclosures it had, even after you account for other factors like overbuilding and subprime lending. A little bit longer answer is that I was raised on the south side of Chicago in a neighborhood that was very integrated and in schools that were majority African American. Many of my friends were middle class African Americans. And so this is something that the interest in this goes back a little bit deeper for me personally.
So what you found with your colleagues, Len Albright from Northeastern and Douglas Massey from Princeton, was that there really is a demonstrable, provable racial penalty. I mean, if you're a person of color and you were trying to buy a house in Baltimore in the 2000s, you were at a distinct disadvantage from people who were white. In what ways were those disadvantages manifested?
There were a couple of ways that we measured in our study. First of all, we found that after you control for things like people's credit score, their income, whether they intend to occupy the property, lots of other very pertinent factors that lenders use to make a loan, we found that black customers ended up paying an unexplained difference, a penalty, as you put it, of $500 a year roughly on average. Sometimes this could be up to $1,000 a year for certain subcategories. And so they were spending hundreds of dollars a year more on their mortgage payments, thousands of dollars more during the time that we studied them from 2000 to 2012. And if they kept that loan, that would be tens of thousands of dollars. So that was one way. Another way was many of these subprime loans, and when we say subprime, we mean loans that have a higher interest rate and have higher risk features, also included risky features. Just to give you one example, like a prepayment penalty. We found that black homeowners were more than three times as likely to have this clause in their mortgage. And what that meant was that if they tried to refinance or to get out of a loan that had bad terms within 2 or 3 years, they would pay a penalty of maybe up to 20% of the balance of that loan, and that would be folded into the next loan. So they would often be kept into these loans that were often predatory, abusive, and had terms that were often deceptive. So these were many of the little costs that accumulated over time for African-American homeowners in the Baltimore sample that we studied.
And the sample that you studied, you examined more than 3,000 mortgage loans that Wells Fargo made. And there was a very, you know, highly publicized settlement that Wells Fargo agreed to pay in 2012. They paid $175 million to settle these allegations of predatory lending. One of the things you found out was that it wasn't just people buying homes in impoverished neighborhoods, but it was middle-class African-Americans, people making $50,000 a year or more. They were particularly hard hit by this.
Yes, that's a very interesting finding that follows from a large literature in sociology. Just on the poverty note, you know, only about 6% of the neighborhoods that we saw with the black homeowners were very high poverty neighborhoods. So we're talking over 90% of these neighborhoods were not very high poverty neighborhoods. They tend to be neighborhoods where more people own their home. And what we found is for blacks who made at least $50,000 a year, which is very close to the average income, we found that they ended up paying a penalty that was higher per year and higher over the life of the loan by several hundred dollars and then several thousand dollars. We suspect that there are a couple of things going on here. First, that these African Americans tend to experience more discrimination because they experience more contact with those who are of another race. Also, we know from other studies that many of the lenders and brokers who were paid to seek out people to receive subprime loans tended to seek out homes that were worth more to get a larger commission, to be paid more, and to seek out neighborhoods where more people were homeowners, right? So it could be more efficient, more effective, their marketing. And so they would go to places that were homeowner neighborhoods that were predominantly African-American customers who were seen as being subprime customers, despite the fact that most subprime loans during the housing boom, about 70%, were for refinancing an existing loan. So we know that these homeowners, for example, if they had owned their home for 10 or 20 years, were perfectly capable, obviously, of paying their loan each month. And what got them into the trouble was not their own personal characteristics. It was the risky features of these loans.
On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning. My guest this morning is Jacob Rue. He's an assistant professor of sociology at Brigham Young University in Utah. We're talking about the mortgage lending crisis and the racial implications of that crisis. Now, Professor, you studied these loans made by Wells Fargo. Obviously, they paid a significant penalty. Is it simply a matter of, you know, the internal policies of this bank or any other bank, or is it a matter of law? And because the obvious question is this still continuing now in 2016? What's your take on where it stands today in Baltimore and cities like it?
It's a great question. I'll break it up into two parts. First of all, we know that what was happening at Wells Fargo at the time in the 2000s was not limited to Wells Fargo. Many of these lenders went out of business. They could not be sued. And Wells Fargo, of course, had disparities that were a little bit larger, but we've seen disparities like this throughout other metropolises, especially racially segregated metropolitan areas. And in this time period, about half of African Americans are living in very intensely segregated metropolitan areas. In terms of today and policy and what can be done, we know that there is no funding or securitization of subprime loans on Wall Street, so that this product is not available right now, although there is subprime lending in the auto market. But things that can be done that we believe in terms of policy are to have a more routine process where at the level of policies and practices, when these patterns emerge that are discriminatory in effect, even if nobody intends them to be so, have them deflagged, have them be remediated, have lenders maybe pay smaller fines, and have them pay attention to these things on a much more routine basis through civil rights enforcement. Of course, this was one of the few cases where there was a large settlement. But as we know, the story of the housing crisis is how very few penalties have been paid, how little accountability there has been. Long legal suits have their place and are very important, but a more widespread possibility is to have civil rights enforcement be much more routine, have people understand and address these problems before they become entrenched and become an issue. Part of the issue as well is that many of the officers that made these loans were paid very large amounts of money, and they were being directed by managers above them who are mostly white males, we know from most of these cases like this one, to look to the black community for these subprime loans. And when a certain community is targeted for these products, they will end up getting them at higher rates, notwithstanding the fact that we know that people had higher credit scores and so forth. So this is a systemic problem that goes to stereotypes, to the idea of race and space, people seeing black spaces as being subprime spaces and so forth. So it does tap into larger issues in our society that, of course, transcend the practices of one single bank.
Yeah, because folks have to understand that if you're an African-American mortgage holder for a 30-year mortgage and it costs you $15,000 or $20,000 more over the course of that loan, that's $15,000 or $20,000 you can't use for your kids' education, or you can't use for home improvements, or you can't use. So when we talk about the income inequality and the wealth inequality, this pertains to this very specifically. I mean, we had
Absolutely.
We had violence in our city a year and a month ago because this inequality kind of bubbled over into a situation where people just really express themselves in some often very harmful ways. You mentioned the car loans. Is that the next frontier for this? I mean, are there still areas of lending that are kind of unregulated or at least poorly overseen the way the mortgages were? Are you worried about that?
I am a bit worried about what's happening in the auto market. I'm not an expert in that area. I think in terms of the housing market, one of the biggest concerns now is exactly what you talked about with the wealth gap. So the wealth gap between blacks and whites in this post-civil rights era has seemingly grown over time. It was about a ratio of 8 to 1, so that a typical white family had 8 times the wealth of a typical black family before the housing boom really got going. By the time of the crash, it was 20 to 1, and recently it settled down to 13 to 1. So this ratio has gone from 8 to 1 to 13 to 1. These are middle-class homeowners who play by the rules, who are looking to make it. Most Americans, regardless of their race, have most of their savings in their home. So this wealth gap issue is absolutely central to understanding how it is, like you said, that the next generation, that wealth is not just the prize at the end. It's also the starting point for the next generation. So they have less money to pay for medical expenses, for college tuition, and so forth. So I think that the ripple effect of this will continue to see in the future. And there is a frustration from, like I say, these homeowners, people participating in the American dream that turn into a nightmare of playing by the rules and coming up short and being, of course, hard hit. And we know that, of course, this was a crisis, right, that was a national in scope, that there would have been a lot of foreclosures in the absence of any discrimination. But we find that, instead of there being 10% of people going to foreclosure, we see about 18%. So that's a big difference, right? That's a very large difference.
Jacob Rue is an assistant professor of sociology at Brigham Young University in Provo, Utah. The article in the journal Social Problems is called Race, Space, and Cumulative Disadvantage, a Case Study of the Subprime Lending Collapse. He and his co-authors, sociologist Len Albright of Northeastern University and Douglas Massey of Princeton University, will be awarded the John Hope Franklin Prize in New Orleans tomorrow night for their look at the subprime housing meltdown and how it affected communities of color here in Baltimore. We'll have a link to the article on our website, wipr.org/Maryland Morning. Dr. Rue, thanks for your time. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much.
Coming up next, producer Rob Sivak chats with our movie mavens, Jed Dietz of the Maryland Film Festival and Anne Hornaday of the Washington Post. I'm Tom Hall. The Maryland Morning Movie Mayhem is coming right up after a break for the news. Stay with us.
Do you have thoughts on that segment you just heard? Email us at mdmorning@wypr.org or find us on Twitter. We are at Maryland Morning. Now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Maryland Morning. I'm senior producer Rob Sivak. And as you can tell from that catchy theme, it's time for our monthly movie mayhem. And for that, we're joined once again by our two fearless film aficionados. Here in the studio with me is Jed Dietz, the founder and executive director of the Maryland Film Festival, which wrapped up its very successful 2016 showcase back on May 8th. And joining us by phone from D.C. is award-winning Washington Post movie critic Anne Hornaday, still recovering from her arduous 10-day assignment covering the Cannes Film Festival in France. Welcome to you both. Thanks for joining
me. Thank you.
There's so much to talk about this morning. We're looking at the first crop of summer movies coming out
including some pretty interesting new installments in the superhero franchise. And we're also looking ahead later this month to one of the top documentary film festivals in the world, right in our backyard, the American Film Institute's Silver Docs Festival, June 22nd to 26th, I think it runs. But before we dive into that good stuff, I want to talk about the film festivals that each of you have been immersed in recently. Cannes is one of the great international cultural and marketing events for filmmakers and film audiences. What were your strongest impressions coming out of Cannes this year?
Well, you know, it's funny because the last few years, Cannes has sort of had a rhythm to it where it starts a little bit slow, and I'm especially interested in what I try to do is go to as many competition films as I can because I try to stay abreast of what's playing, but also kind of what that augurs in terms of the festival's taste and its programming, what it deems sort of culturally significant and important and cinematically innovative. And you know, the last couple of years, I have to say, the competition films haven't really been. I've found a lot of mediocrity there. I've found a lot of films that I think they program in order to sort of reward good friends of the festival, regardless of the relative merits of a film. But then, you know, so I'm always grumbling during the first half. But then, lo and behold, when I leave, I usually leave with a pocket full of films that I really feel good about, and that was certainly the case this year. I mean, I came away really high on at least five or six movies, a couple of which did not even play in competition, that are coming our way pretty soon. One is called Captain Fantastic, with Viggo Mortensen as sort of a counterculture dad raising his kids in the wilderness of the Pacific Northwest.
That's not a superhero movie, right?
Well, he's a superhero to his children. But it's just it's written and directed by an actor named Matt Ross, who's sort of a well-known fixture in the indie world and has been on Silicon Valley and different TV shows. But really funny, affectionate, warm, brilliantly written, very smart dialogue, and just a terrific central performance from Viggo. And that's coming our way in a few weeks in July. And then another film called Hell or High Water, which is sort of a straight-up genre exercise. It's a modern-day Western, very much in the tradition of a No Country for Old Men. Just between you, me, and the rest of the world, I liked it more than No Country for Old Men, because I thought it was less pretentious and less sort of literary, you know, high-minded. But it stars Chris Pine, Ben Foster, and Jeff Bridges in a really, again, you know, a genre exercise, but incredibly well executed and very much of its time in terms of being located within the economic malaise of the last few years and the banking crisis. It was written by the same guy who wrote Sicario, which I drug thriller that a lot of people admired last year, and directed by a guy named David McKenzie. But the awards, the competition films were good too. Two standouts for me were The New Jim Jarmusch, a beautifully observed sort of quiet little drama called Patterson about a poet living in Patterson, New Jersey, poet being played by Adam Driver, and then Loving, which is Jeff Nichols' dramatization of the landmark Supreme Court case that declared quote-unquote miscegenation laws unconstitutional. And that stars Ruth Negah and Joel Edgerton as the couple who brought that suit, and it's just a
permitting interracial marriage. Yes.
Indeed, exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, very interesting.
So there was a lot, you know, there was a lot to come home and feel good about.
You also wrote from Cannes. I followed your reporting, and you pointed out in one of your pieces how the films at Cannes seemed especially grounded in real-world issues.
Definitely.
And that there were films about women that stood out prominently.
Yes. And again, in recent years, you know, the festival has come under, I think, you know, understandable criticism for not programming more female filmmakers. It ticked up a little bit this year. But in addition to a few more women directors, there were many more female-centered stories. And so we had Andrea Arnold, who did a fantastic film a few years ago called Fish Tank with Michael Fassbender. Her movie, American Honey, stars Shia LaBeouf. He's the most well-known actor, but it's a real ensemble piece, very much anchored by this new actress that she discovered, about a group of itinerant magazine subscription salespeople, teenagers that are kind of vague, you know, they're a little bit unmoored and they don't have very stable lives, and they kind of seek refuge in this van that's traveling across the Midwest. A real lively piece of social realism. I thought it kind of got into a little bit of voyeurism a little bit, you know, it kind of teeters on the brink of that, but a very people loved that movie at the festival. I mean, it was a real popular one. Ken Loach's film, which ended up winning the Palme d'Or, called I, Daniel Blake, is very much about the British welfare bureaucracy and people getting entangled in that, absolutely of the moment. And then, you know, we had movies like A Patterson, which isn't necessarily political, but is very much about everyday lives. And I would argue loving, even though it was that's a very political and historical film. It I think, focuses on just the day-in, day-out lives of real people just getting along and getting by and being in love and building a family and building a life. And there was just something so moving about that being depicted so heroically in these films and just so beautifully. I was really moved by it.
Director Woody Allen's new film, Café Society, also was showcased at Cannes, and there was a bit of an uproar. There were some protests surrounding the child sex abuse allegations that have been dogging Mr. Allen for quite some time now, allegations coming from his ex-wife Mia Farrow's family. To what extent did that ruffle Mr. Allen's debut of this film? And was it a big issue at Cannes?
Well, yes and no. I mean, what happened was his new movie, Café Society, was the opening night film. And the day of that event, his estranged son, Ronan Farrow, published a very incendiary essay in The Hollywood Reporter. And everybody picks up The Hollywood Reporter first thing in the morning, whether they're picking it up as a physical copy in a hotel lobby or they're downloading it on their phones. So, you know, him basically excoriating the entertainment press for not holding Woody Allen's feet to the fire about these allegations more fiercely, and also taking the actors to task who work with him for working with him. And so, you know, that did create a stir, of course. You know, people were talking about it. And then at the ceremony itself that night, the opening night screening, a French comedian who was an MC of the event made a few kind of off-color jokes,
kind of referencing Roman Polanski's situation.
Yeah, I cannot. I wasn't there. I don't even remember the quote-unquote the joke. But so those were the kind of the two talking points. The next day, he did meet with the press at a luncheon, and we were all able to talk with him. A few people at a round table, and he and the cast members would kind of flip from table to table and sit with us for about 20 minutes. And we did bring it up. I mean, I and my colleague, Steve Zajcik from the LA Times, did ask him. I wanted to know more about, there's a line in the new movie that kind of gets to the complicated family dynamics of his own history marrying Suni. And I asked him about that. And as he has done before, every time I've talked to him, which is twice now, he was utterly unfazed and said, oh, sure, yes, you know, that is, you know, you're right. Technically, Mia is my mother-in-law. He had no problem. You know, he didn't look particularly troubled by the question or by the fact that a lot of audience members are going to make that association with the film. And then Steve Zajcik followed up asking him about the Ronan essay. And as he does every time we bring this up, he says, he refers us to the article that he wrote for the New York Times a few years ago about the specific sex abuse allegations. And basically said, it's, you know, I don't pay much attention to it. I've said what I've said. I do my work, make of it what you will, and there you have it. And so, I mean, I've never found him to be the least bit defensive or bothered or ruffled or anything about it.
Yeah. What did you think of Café Society?
It's fun. I wouldn't put it up into the great pantheon of his best, but it's delightful. It's a period piece. It takes place in the 1930s in Hollywood and New York, with terrific central performances by Jesse Eisenberg and Kristen Stewart, who I would argue, you know, isn't exactly, I think she's kind of oddly cast in this role. It's almost like an ingenue role, and she's not an ingenue. And, you know, she's got that sultry, smoky intrigue about her, but she's utterly mesmerizing on screen, and you're just riveted to her. She played in another film at the festival by Olivier Assayas. Same thing. She's a commanding screen presence.
Yeah.
No question.
We're talking with Washington Post film critic Anne Hornaday, just back from the Cannes Film Festival. And with me here in the studio is Jed Dietz, the founder and executive director of the Maryland Film Festival. Jed, the contrast between the two festivals strikes me as very interesting. We spent last month talking about we had a number of directors, filmmakers in from the who showcased at the film festival, your Maryland Film Festival, and one of the things they said was how filmmaker friendly, how intimate and interactive the festival is. How do you compare this with Cannes?
Well, they're completely different animals. Cannes and Sundance, and there are a couple others, but those would be the two big ones, are market festivals. So the filmmakers go there to get marketing traction for their new film. In Cannes' case, there's also a whole part of the Cannes Film Festival that's about financing new films that doesn't get much press, but is a huge part of the festival. And what we're trying to do is, yeah, I think that world is well filled. The marketing traction is well served by Cannes and Sundance and a few others. Mm-hmm. And what we're trying to do is give the filmmakers a chance with audiences to get together, let the filmmakers together talk about all the issues they're facing as they go into the marketplace and also financing. And also then interact with audiences who are not industry people, who are real audiences, the kinds of audiences that they will need support from to build a career. And they love being here in Baltimore with those audiences. And it's a very different kind of dynamic, I think, than the great, you know, and Cannes and Sundance are truly great festivals. But I think we've found a way to contribute to the film community through this other kind of gathering with no awards, no categories, and several structured opportunities for the filmmakers to really get together in a very honest way and talk to mm-hmm. each other as artists trying to make films and get them to audiences.
Are there any standout films that are going into wider release?
Yeah, there. I mean, some we don't know about yet. But today, a wonderful documentary called "The Fits" that we had at the festival is opened in New York. It's beginning now. It's marketing rollout. There are the reviews that appeared in this morning's Wall Street Journal and the New York Times are just extraordinary. This is an emerging filmmaker, Anna Rose Homer, who had produced before, and she's made this extraordinary documentary film called The Fits. Mm-hmm. So that's one. There's another fiction film called Morris from America that we had at the festival has already started to go out worldwide in festivals, and I'm sure you're going to hear about a lot. Greg Robinson is the lead actor. The guy playing his son is a brand new actor who's unbelievable in this, a guy named Marquise Christmas. There are a couple other docs, Life Animated, that is for sure will be seen in multiple ways, and the Norman Lear doc. There's a very mysterious and wonderful, fascinating doc called Kate Plays Christine. Those will all for sure be coming into the marketplace during the summer.
Mm-hmm. And what films stand out to you in this first crop of summer releases? Are there any films that people should be making a point of seeing right now?
Well, I mean, I would, again, point them to the wonderful Captain Fantastic. Again, that doesn't open until July. I mean, you mentioned the superhero glut, which we definitely are in the midst of. I think, you know, it kind of started off with Batman versus Superman, which I didn't really think terribly highly of. And then, of course, X-Men Apocalypse just opened. But I think of all of them, I would probably, if you're in the mood for a comic book movie, I would point you toward Captain I'm going to say Captain Fantastic, Captain America.
Captain America.
The Marvel. It's a little bit overstuffed. I mean, there are lots and lots of characters, and it's very busy, as most of these are now, and I think it's signaling some kind of exhaustion of the genre and a breaking point that films and audiences are probably going to reach pretty soon. But I think it's extremely well made, and it features for my money, a wonderful performance from Robert Downey Jr. You know, I mean, we're so used to him now, and he does kind of ham it up and be the cock of the walk, especially as Iron Man. But this is a real performance, and it reminded me of just what a gifted actor he is. But then we have little movies like I'm a fan of this little rom-com called Maggie's Plan.
With Ethan Hawke, yeah.
With the underrated Ethan Hawke, who just was in a movie called Born to be Blue, starring as Chet Baker, a terrific performance, a really accomplished dramatic performance. And here it's more in the rom-com vein, but another just a terrific portrayal of this college professor who ends up having an affair and his marriage breaks up, and the two women in his life are played by Greta Gerwig and Julianne Moore, who just sends the movie into the stratosphere. I mean, she's just so wonderful.
Jed, some of your picks. Summer movie picks.
Yeah, there's a movie right now at the Charles called The Man Who Played Infinity, which is based on a true story. It stars Jeremy Irons and Dev Patel, so it's a recreation of this true story.
Just got a few seconds.
Of this incredible mathematician who came out of the streets of India and was mentored by a professor at Cambridge. And it's the book from which it's adapted is by a guy who lives in Baltimore named Robert Canicle. So go see it.
We're going to have to leave it there. I can hear the theme coming in. We've been enjoying the unique film perspectives of Maryland Film Festival founder and director Jed Dietz and Anne Hornaday, the Washington Post's film critic, who joined us by phone from her D.C. office. Thank you both, and we'll see you next month.
Thanks, Rob.
We'll have links to their websites and to the festivals we've mentioned this morning on our website at wypr.org/Maryland Morning. I'm Rob Sivek. Coming up after a break for the news, Tom Hall returns for a conversation with Baltimore Symphony Orchestra's principal trumpeter, Andrew Balio, about his vision for the future of the classical music genre.
Is there an issue that you'd like to see us cover? Let us know. You can email us at mdmorning@wypr.org, or you can leave us a voicemail. Just call 410-881-3162. Visit us on the web to leave comments or to hear previous episodes. That's all at wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, on with the show.
Welcome back. It's Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Tom Hall. Next week, executives, musicians, and leaders of classical orchestras from around the country will gather in Baltimore for the annual conference of the League of American Symphony Orchestras. The theme of the conference is the richness of difference. One of the things that is different about orchestras these days is that they are redoubling efforts to connect in significant ways with their communities. For the Baltimore Symphony and orchestras around the country, this has meant expanding their missions to include not only giving concerts, but educational activities and programming that attracts non-traditional audiences. My next guest this morning is Andrew Balio. He's the principal trumpet of the Baltimore Symphony and my friend and colleague who plays with the Baltimore Choral Arts Orchestra as well. Here's a bit of Bach that Andrew and I performed together a couple of years ago. Balio has given a lot of thought to the position of orchestras in society and what it'll take for them to survive on an increasingly busy media landscape. The experience of and the inclination towards concert going is changing. And to ponder how those changes will affect orchestras and audiences, Andrew has founded an organization called the Future Symphony Institute. This morning, a conversation about where orchestras are headed. Andrew Balio joins me in the studio. Andy, good to see you.
Tom, great to see you.
So the Future Symphony Institute is a way of sort of rethinking how orchestras present themselves to the public.
Exactly. It's a nonprofit think tank that we founded here in Baltimore as a result of my work with the BSO and our efforts in trying to reach all the citizens and adapting to the way of the new consumer.
So by new consumer, are you talking about the typical person who's already going to the symphony who is changing her predilections, or are you talking about a brand new person who's never darkened the halls of Symphony Hall?
Well, for me, it's about identifying those people who are just on the cusp of possibly attending the symphony orchestra. It might be a person who has some extra time on their hands, and they are able to start asking questions about things that they may have overlooked. You know, these are people we call culturally curious. They may be very interested in art or theater, but they never really took the time to get into classical music. Those are the people we want to pull in.
They used to refer to them, because obviously with my work with the Baltimore Choral Arts Society, I've been worrying about this for 35 years, too.
You've walked this long time.
Yeah. They used to call them CANAs, C-A-N-A, culturally aware non-attenders. So they're people who know about the symphony. They know about center stage. They know about the lyric opera, but they maybe just never actually get themselves going. That's one group of people.
Precisely.
There's another group of people who live in neighborhoods that traditionally don't have great concentrations of people who go to the symphony and the museums and the opera companies around the world.
And within those very populations, rather than speaking about them as demographics, as the arts are utterly obsessed with, our organization focuses on the psychographic, the inner qualities. Demographic is about a person's age or income or race, whereas in psychographics, it's far murkier, and it's about psychological profiles, and it's harder to get at, but it's the difference between a person who likes Ford pickup trucks versus a person who, you know, likes a BMW. You know, there's inner issues. So within those...
Does that mean that, you know, you've got to identify all the people who prefer BMWs because they're inclined to classical music, or is it the case also that people who drive pickup trucks also really like classical
music? You never know, because there are plenty of people who drive the BMW who would never be caught dead in a classical concert. Again, within that second population you talk about, they have something about, you know, their personality that would draw them. It tends to be people who are willing to work for their pleasure. It'd be I would cite fly fishermen who are willing to make these lures for the fish. It'd be someone who prefers chess over checkers. Maybe somebody who was a stamp or coin collector. You never know.
So it's not a matter of income. It's not a matter of, you know, even tradition or, you know, what happened in your family or anything like that.
Exactly. And so it's harder to ferret these people out. We're always trying to answer one key question, which is how to increase demand for classical music. That spawns 100 other questions. It's a complicated issue, but it's not overly complex.
One of the things you've done is you've consulted with some folks in London about redesigning a concert hall.
Yes.
That's interesting. So the physical space of where people are attending music concerts matters an awful lot.
And that's because it's been known that it's time for the London Symphony to get their own concert hall, one that's fitting of the London Symphony. They've had the Barbican, which is severely dysfunctional. It's a giant concrete bunker, kind of like that Verizon switching center on Charles Street. You know, what always happens when municipalities want to build a huge concert hall, of course, they decide to make something big and, you know, spaceship-like, and we're taking an opposite approach. We engaged with Leon Creer, a tremendous architect from the New Urbanist movement, and he designed for us a campus, a very open sort of garden area that we decided to propose putting in the corner of Regent's Park in a place called Park Crescent. So it's just all these smaller buildings where they have their educational facility and a concert hall that fits in perfectly with the traditional architecture of that neighborhood. So that's very different than imposing these huge monolithic buildings on neighborhoods.
Well, the room that you and I just worked in last weekend, you know,
right,
the Meyerhoff Symphony Hall,
yeah,
is a pretty monolithic, huge building. Is that just not the future? Because it is the future. It's where the symphony lives. It's where the Choral Arts Society performs.
Well, as a musician, I adore that building because it sounds so great. What happened with the Meyerhoff is it was put in a pretty challenging corner of Mount Vernon, and we're going to rectify that, meaning, you know, the BSO with MICA and the city, we're looking at connecting it. And that's where New Urbanism comes in. That's urban planning. So it's not enough just to put a fine concert hall on a patch of grass and then say, you know, build it and they will come. There's so much more external.
It's about
planning.
Integrating it with the rest of the community.
Yeah,
in what ways can you integrate a building that's that big and that's beautiful? And as you say, it sounds great in there.
Yes, it does. Well, like all concert halls in the U.S. these days, the foyer was conceived as kind of like as a holding pen, you know, hold the cattle until they're ready to go into the main event, the concert. Whereas our vision for the classical music concert hall is that we would conceive the foyer as a gathering area for the community. It would be open throughout the day. It would be a place, you know, kind of like what hotels have done to create, you know.
It's a place where people hang out.
Yeah,
so
exactly.
Concerts aren't the only thing they do there.
Precisely, that we're trying to nurture socializing so that people would come to a concert for 2 hours before, hang out for an hour afterwards. And even during the day, I like to think of the Meyerhoff as a place where MICA students would come to do their work, or UB students would come to hang out. We call it a shared workspace.
There's lots of different ways of thinking through this. It's mm-hmm. interesting that you're generating these ideas. So thanks very much. You got a concert coming up tomorrow night to help raise money for the Future Institute. And so break a leg.
Thank you so much.
Folks about it. Andrew Balio is the principal trumpet player of the Baltimore Symphony Orchestra and the founder of the Future Symphony Institute. He'll be playing a job tomorrow night at the Music Barn at Silo Hill in Phoenix, up in northern Baltimore County. A beautiful place for a concert. That event begins at 6 o'clock. Proceeds will benefit the Future Symphony Institute. We've got a link to information on our website, wipr.org/Maryland Morning. Maryland Morning's director, engineer, and co-host is Nathan Sterner. The show is produced by Rob Sivak, Bridget Armstrong, and Kathleen Cahill, with production help from Lauren Ferguson. Austin Coughlin from Clean Cuts wrote and recorded the Maryland Morning theme music. Coffee for our guests provided by Zeke's Coffee in Lauraville. You can find them online at zekescoffee.com. You can find us back here Monday morning when we talk with leaders of a nonprofit organization called Baltimore's Promise about improving outcomes for kids in the city, and an expert on literature for children to improve their reading lists. Until then, I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for listening. Garrison Keillor's up next with the Writer's Almanac. Have a great weekend.